Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host.
Hello and welcome back to the show. And I'm your host, Brother Adam Thayer. We've picked some rather weighty articles for this week, so let's go ahead and just get started. First up is an article by someone who isn't even a Mason at all. It's titled The Power of Symbols by Natasha Dern, and it was published in the Huffington Post back in 2010. The language of the soul is not literal, but symbolic. A creative language that speaks in the form of colors, objects, shapes, art, poetry, riddles, images, and metaphors. The soul chooses to convey messages in ambiguous terms, is not direct in its approach. For example, the soul may want to alter your perception about the color black. It will not come out and tell you that it wants to do this, but what it will do is send you promptings in the forms of moods, insights, feelings, ideas to help you decode its message. We believe that the universe does not hear our requests or our pleas for help or guidance, but on the contrary, it contacts us via the above-mentioned routes or answers us using symbolic tongues that we do not yet understand. To become acquainted with universal symbols and their meaning is a valuable asset to your life. Symbols are a powerful influence on our psychological and spiritual life. Within our inner world, a symbol can present potential or calling meant only for your understanding. Humanity has always used symbols to express its awareness of the divine, the creative force. Such expressions resulted in symbolic stories, such as myths and legends, that have been used to express abstract qualities such as truth, honor, justice, heroism, love, wisdom, forgiveness, and courage. These qualities are innate within all of humanity, and it can be brought into consciousness where they express themselves in the form of symbols. On an individual level, it is highly encouraged to identify and focus upon symbols that hold special meanings for you. At first, these symbols may appear in dreams, doodles, but over time they become personalized, take on a deeper meaning, and come to represent aspects of our psyche that had previously remained dormant or difficult to put into words. Through the art of meditation, all the major religions around the world have harnessed the power of symbols in the quest for spiritual transformation. What are the benefits of using symbols during meditation? The use of symbols helps the mind to focus on a single element and to pacify its restless nature. In return, the symbol stimulates thoughts and insights, stirs and awakens the deeper mind. The aim of using symbols in meditation is to move beyond linguistic interpretations and uncover a level of intuitive understanding beyond language, which profoundly transforms the way we experience the world and ourselves. In practice, most meditative traditions use symbols as a point of departure because they provide a pathway back to our spiritual roots. For example, in Native American traditions, nature herself is such a symbol. It provides the meditator a point of departure into the deeper, mysterious layers of the mind. So, the meditator might gaze upon the earth and feel her under his or her body, or commune in silence with the trees and flowers. Symbols are a tool on the spiritual path, one of many. I highly encourage you to identify and focus upon symbols that call to you, that stir your imagination, that resonate with you on a deep level. By identifying what draws your attention, whether it is a particular color, a shape, a religious icon, or even animals, you'll find that over time, they take on a deeper meaning and come to represent aspects of your soul that were previously unknown. By becoming conscious of what attracts you and by understanding its significance within your inner world, you help bring about its manifestation. Symbols mirror rich inner resources that must be harnessed for them to become a reality. Be mindful of what captures your essence on a daily basis, because each time you are, you get ever closer to uncovering a piece of your soul's mystery. Symbols are more than just historical and cultural icons. They can help us move toward a fuller and deeper understanding of our spiritual identities. And again, that was by Natasha Dern, and it was published in the Huffington Post. A friend of mine actually sent me this in an email, and I was just absolutely fascinated when I read it. I had to reread it 3 or 4 times. We take symbols for granted sometimes in Masonry because we are so dense with how many are available. It's a good reminder of what a symbol is really meant to do for us. Speaking of a symbol, the next article that I had to read is called Amos, What Seest Thou? And it was by Ray W. Burgess, past Grand Master of Louisiana. In all the lodges under the jurisdiction of the Grand Lodge of the State of Louisiana and many other jurisdictions, the volume of the sacred law should be open at the 7th chapter of Amos in the Fellowcraft degree. Why do we do this? This practice is not universal, but ours has the sanctity of long use and the sacredness of the familiar. Also, since one of the working tools of a Fellowcraft Mason is the plum, it is appropriate to open the Bible at the story about the plumb line of the Lord. What do we really know about this man, the prophet Amos? Do we know why the Lord called him to deliver his message of judgment to his people of Israel? Solomon received from his father David a powerful empire. During his latter years, however, it began to fall apart. Expensive building projects sapped the strength and loyalty of native Israelites. As the tributary nation saw the opportunity to assert their independence, they did so, and Solomon was unable to prevent the disintegration of the empire. Before Solomon's death, the Aramaeans severed themselves from his kingdom, and shortly after, he was succeeded by Rehoboam. A further split took place. With the breakdown of the monarchy, subject states declared their independence, so that the territory once ruled by David was divided into autonomous units. The portion of Solomon's empire north of Mount Hermon, extending as far as the Euphrates, revolted and formed the kingdom of Syria with Damascus as its capital. South of Syria was the kingdom of the 10 tribes, known as Israel, or the Northern Kingdom, with its capital at Shechem. The Northern Kingdom included the larger portion of Palestine proper, an area of about 9,400 square miles. The Kingdom of Judah included the tribe of that name, a portion of Benjamin and Simeon, which had been incorporated earlier into Judah. Kings of the Davidic line reigned over Judah until the fall of Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, in 587 BC. Solomon retained control over Moab, but his successor found the Moabites hard to keep in subjection. Moab disappeared as a political power when Nebuchadnezzar subjugated the country. South of the Dead Sea was the kingdom of Edom, which had been conquered by David and remained tributary during the reign of Solomon. The three kingdoms which developed from Solomon's kingdom in western Palestine, Syria, Israel, and Judah, strove for supremacy. Wars were constant between Israel and Judah. With the threat to both Israel and Judah from the powerful Syrian state of Damascus, there developed a tendency for the two states to reconcile their differences. During the reigns of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Jeroboam II, king of Israel, the sister states pushed their boundaries out to include the territories which once belonged to Israel under David and Solomon. Many of the smaller nations were required to pay tribute to Israel and Judah. Both kingdoms collected tolls from the caravans that passed through their lands. In this period, in both Israel and Judah, there was a transition from an agricultural to a commercial way of life. Industries and cities sprang up, which gave rise to a class of wealthy merchants and landholders. This new wealthy class built winter and summer homes out of hewn stone, elaborately adorned and decorated. They had couches inlaid with ivory, covered with the tiniest imported silk, upon which they reclined while eating prime cuts of meat, drinking wine out of bowls, and listening to strains of varied music. But the presence of great wealth did not mean that there was no poverty in the land. The extremely rich had obtained much of their wealth by their merciless oppression of the poor, taking exactions of wheat from them. The merchants used false weights and measures in their business transaction, in addition to selling refuse wheat. Because the unscrupulous men were able to bribe the judges, no redress was left for the innocent. The tragedy of all this was that Israel's social structure was completely disrupted. Israel had originally been a covenant community in which there was no class distinction. All men were equal before the law, God, and one another. Now, all this had changed. Wealth, power, and affluence came to some in Israel, but the affluent, rather than using their wealth to benefit all of God's people, squandered it on luxuries and status symbols and used their newly gained power to keep their poor brothers in subjugation. One would think that, in light of the conditions just described, there would have been little interest in religion in those days. Just the reverse was true. The people were very religious, especially the rich. Religious services were well attended. Tithes and offerings were freely and punctually given. Impressive festivals were held, and pilgrimages were made to the important religious centers. They thought they were in the favor of God and under His protection. However, just the opposite was true. The Lord despised their feasts and would not accept their sacrifices. Their worship was a profane travesty. It was an act of men and women morally unclean and unwilling to submit themselves to the searching discipline of God. God had entered into a covenant with Israel. God had chosen Israel out of all the families of the earth. God had given her a land and had given her people special laws to guide them in the way they should go. It seems that Israel believed the covenant to be inviolable and that it gave her privileges and a license that no other nation had. But Israel broke her covenant. She used her freedom from bondage to enslave a large segment of her own people. The gift of the land she used for selfish purposes. She rejected the law of God and walked after lies. What was God going to do in the face of Israel's sin? Would he ignore it? Would he wink at it? Or would he stop turning away the punishment from Israel? The answer was no. He would stop turning away the punishment from Israel. The end had come. Was there no hope for Israel? Was there no way to escape the impending judgment of God? There was only a slight possibility, only that possibility found in the sovereignty of God. And here is where we begin the story of Amos. Very little is known about the man Amos. He is never mentioned by any other biblical writer. All the information we have about him comes from the little book which bears his name. Amos's name probably means burdened or burden-bearer. Amos lived in Tekoa, a village in Judah about 11 miles south of Jerusalem and 18 miles west of the Dead Sea. Tekoa was located in a barren, rock-bound region, surrounded on three sides by limestone hills and a breathtaking view of the Dead Sea. Amos was a shepherd or herdsman and dresser of sycamore trees or wild figs. He was probably a very poor man, since his sympathies were with the poor against their rich oppressors. Although he was a shepherd and one who performed menial tasks, he was by no means uneducated. His formal training might have been nil, but he was a keen observer of the ways of God and men. Awareness and sensitivity characterized the man. His literary style was free and pure. Amos lived in the time of the earthquake, just as the northern kingdom of Israel was coming to a close. Seemingly, before anyone else in his generation, Amos heard the lion's roar of God's wrath. He's generally recognized as the first of the writing prophets in Israel. He introduced a new element into Old Testament prophecy. He was the first to preach a message of judgment that meant the end of the kingdom of Israel. At about 760 BC, God called Amos to deliver his message of judgment to the people of Israel. In spite of his humble background, he was the one God chose to preach his message of repentance and warning to a rebellious nation. Amos possessed a sense of unquestioned obedience and a clear proclamation of God's message. He was committed to the Lord and his principles of holiness and righteousness. Amos began his ministry with biting words of judgment against the six nations surrounding the land of Judah and Israel. Next, he announced God's judgment against Judah, but Amos was only warming up to his main objective, a vivid description of God's judgment against the nation of Israel. Amos condemned the people of Israel for their oppression of the poor, worship of idols, rejection of God's salvation, and defilement of the Lord's holy name. Twice, Amos saw the judgment of God coming and interceded for Israel, and God turned away his judgment. But with the third vision, that of the plumb line, we come to the title of this dissertation, "Thus He Showed Me." And behold, the Lord stood upon a wall made by a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. And the Lord said unto me, "Amos, what seest thou?" And I said, "A plumb line." And said the Lord, "Behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not again pass by them any more." Amos chapter 7, verse 7 to 8. The prophet Amos was the prophet of righteousness, and he saw the Lord God as judging Israel by means of the plumb line, signifying the unchanging standards of that righteousness. Let us look further at this plumb line. What is a plumb line? It is a simple tool made of a cord with a weight attached to one end. It is used by brick masons and other builders to test the verticality of a wall or other structure. If a wall or a foundation leans, it is out of plumb. So why did God say, "I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel"? Because the plumb admonishes us to walk uprightly in our several stations before God and man. The people of Israel had sinned, and in spite of the warnings of Amos, they had not re-entered the fold. God made it very plain that each man must try himself by the unerring standards of the plumb line. The plumb line is the symbol of uprightness for character, of integrity, of honesty and fair dealings among persons. To plumb one's life and actions is to test them by the eternal laws to God. In all of these tests, the people of Israel had failed. That's why he said, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. So it is with Freemasonry. The real worth of a Mason can never be measured in the opinion of his fellows or in the Masonic honors he has attained. The standard by which a Mason must be judged is by his own evaluation of his conduct and by the principles which he knows to be the unerring and unchanging ones. What can a Freemason expect to get from Freemasonry? The rewards of Freemasonry and the wages of Masons are endless, so long as a man is willing to strive for them. If he is content to be a button Mason, paying his dues merely for the privileges of wearing a pin, this is just what he will get out of Masonry. If he is content to be a knife and fork Mason, showing up at his lodge only when there is some type of banquet, he will receive only this from Masonry. If, however, he measures himself by the plumb and sets his standards accordingly, he will benefit from Masonic education, from Masonic philosophy, and from the association with the finest men in his community. The standard by which a man judges himself as a Mason is the same unerring principle by which he judges himself as a family man, as a church man, as a businessman, and as a citizen. He will learn to walk uprightly in all his endeavors, learning from the plumb the lesson of rectitude of conduct. Each man must stand by the plumb line which is set in the midst of God's people. Again, that was from Brother Burgess, who was a past Grand Master of Louisiana. The article was originally published in the Louisiana Freemason and republished by the Short Talk Bulletins. Finally, we have a book review that I actually wrote. I had planned on saving this for another day, but since we're here, now seems as good a time as any. The book was titled Measured Expectations. One of the greatest duties I've been called for as a writer is to be a book reviewer. Not only does it afford me the opportunity to count my reading time as work, but it exposes me to multiple great works that I might otherwise never have discovered. Such was the case with Measured Expectations, The Challenges of Today's Freemasonry by Brother Michael R. Pohl, which I only learned of when I was asked to review it. Now, I've enjoyed Brother Pohl's other works greatly, and specifically, his Masonic edition of Robert's Rules of Order has proven an invaluable reference during my time as Worshipful Master. If you have ever read any of his books on philosophy or esotericism, you should have a rudimentary idea of what to expect here. This book, as with many of Brother Pohl's other books, isn't necessarily intended to be read start to finish, although you are definitely welcome to do so. Instead, each chapter serves as a short, standalone education piece, suitable for either private reflection or for a supplement to your lodge's education program. As such, it becomes very difficult to review this as a book, and we must instead look at it as a collection of papers sharing the same basic theme. With any collection such as this, there will be some works that are stronger than others, and some that are more meaningful, to you in your current journey than the rest. If I had my way, every single Mason would be forced to read the first paper, titled A Young Man Joins a Masonic Lodge, before their annual elections. I believe this one paper to be of such high importance to understanding the current problems in Freemasonry that I think it should be distributed as far as possible. And this paper alone is worth the purchase price of the book. Another paper that I found fascinating had to do with the symbolism and history of the double-headed eagle. I would love to see the ideas in this chapter expanded on, as it could almost be a book to itself. My only frustration is that it was much too short, and Brother Pohl had to stop the article before really delving deeply into the ideas he brought up. The remainder of the papers in the book delve into subjects such as music, the history and role of ritual, understanding the culture of different lodges, and a brief examination of the modern Scottish Rite. Conspicuously absent is any discussion of the York Rite. Now, I'm not certain if Brother Pohl does not find it an interesting topic, or if he doesn't feel qualified to discuss it. However, I would have loved to have seen his take on the modern York Rite in the same manner he discusses the Scottish Rite. Measured Expectations is necessarily repetitive at times. As a collection of papers, some themes are touched on in multiple different papers, and each time it is from the standpoint that you didn't read any of the previous ones. This isn't a bad thing, since the intention is to use each chapter by itself. However, it is something to be aware of if you choose to read it start to finish, as I did. The intention of this book is to help brothers who are newer to Masonic education find a foot in the door, and it exceeds expectations for that. The topics presented and writing styles are all simple enough for a newer Mason, or one who is just finding an interest in learning more, to gain significant insight from, without boring the more experienced Mason. If this book makes you curious to start doing more in-depth research of your own, Brother Pohl should consider himself highly successful. All right, that's all we have time for this week. Be sure to stop by our limited edition shop on wcypodcast.com and pick up a pin, some cufflinks, or a tie bar. While you're there, click on the Support the Show link to find out more about our sponsors who offer some amazing products, some fantastic discounts, and who donate a portion of your purchase back to keeping our lights running and the podcast streaming. If you have any questions for me, you can drop me an email at adam@wcypodcast.com, or you can send an email to Brother RJ at admin@wcypodcast.com. We'll talk to you again next week, and keep searching for more life.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Be sure to join us for our next edition.